Welcome to the candy shop. We speaking on things you not. Just press play and let it rock. Welcome to the candy shop. Whoa. Welcome to the candy shop. We speaking on things you not. Just press play and let it rock. Welcome to the candy shop. Whoa. Feel like we going through mad things. Gotta keep it real when they choose not. We gon' talk about it when the news drop. Welcome to the show where you know we don't fake this. Keep your opinion to yourself if it don't make sense.
Hey, 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 podcast family. It is your girl, Candidly Kristen, and this is The Candid Shop, your number one destination for candid conversations. If you are new here, welcome, welcome, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back and thanks as always for your support. So today I am doing an author spotlight, and the spotlight is shining on historian and author of The New Suburbia, How Diversity Remade Suburban Life in Los Angeles After 1945, Becky Nicolades. And I forgot to ask her how to pronounce her name, and I hope I got it right. So help me welcome Becky to the Candid Shop. Welcome, 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 Becky.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And did I get your name right?
You know, it's pretty good. Yeah, Nicolaides.
Nicolaides. Okay. I was close. Darn it. That's the one thing I always try to ask, and I forgot today. So I am sure some of my listeners are probably sitting there saying, New Suburbia, like, what the heck is that? So, Becky, if you could first give me and my listeners just a brief glimpse into who you are, and then tell us what inspired you to delve into the topic of air quotes new suburbia, aka suburban diversity, and then write this book.
Sure. I'm a historian. I grew up in Los Angeles and went to school here to college, and then moved to New York where I did my graduate education, but I've always been My heart has always been in Los Angeles, and I've been fascinated with this place for a long time. I ended up as a historian focusing my work on the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs, and I've kind of found them fascinating as a historian, trying to kind of understand, you know, how these places develop, what's been going on in them. And so my first book was, which was called My Blue Heaven, was on working class suburbs in Los Angeles. And that kind of, you know, sort of challenged that old image of suburbia as these sort of white middle class places of, you know, some advantage and that kind of thing. So in that work, I really found a different kind of story where it was still a story of whites, but they were blue collar workers and people kind of scrounging and scraping to get by and using the suburbs in a way to do that. That story and that book took the story up through 1965. And okay. I knew that there was a lot more to look at, especially in LA. And so I wanted to circle back and kind of, you know, take the story up closer to our own time now, and cast a much wider net also across a lot of Los Angeles. That first book just kind of focused on one specific part of Southeast LA. So I knew there were a lot more suburban stories to tell, and I wanted to come back to that.
Okay.
And then in terms of this book, so LA is at the cutting edge of a lot of trends in this country, and the diversification of the suburb is definitely one of those. And so when I started digging into kind of post-1960s story of LA, what I found was, yes, the suburbs were definitely segregated. They were heavily white and cordoned off racially in the 50s and 60s. But after 1970, things really started to diversify. And that story took center stage in this book. It just opened up so many questions and interesting ways of kind of understanding like what is happening in these communities when they transition from white to much more multiracial and multi-ethnic. And it's that phase like after 1970 that I call the new suburbia. And that is because it really became diverse to a much greater level than ever in terms of like history. It was reaching, that diversity was reaching unprecedented levels at that point.
Okay. All right. So in your research, what ways did you see that race, ethnicity, socioeconomic diversity kind of intersected to kind of shape the development of the new suburbia, the new suburban communities?
Yeah, I mean, so what happens after 1970, you know, we all know the story, familiar story of the suburbs, that they were really segregated spaces for a lot of their history. It's the sort of Jordan Peele, you know, get out vision that a lot of us know. And, you know, that's a pretty familiar history. And it was true, you know, in many, many communities. And LA, I think, was notorious for like pioneering some of those tactics of segregation. And so that was really in racial segregation, especially. So a lot of that was really super entrenched, like through the 50s and 60s. And then after 1970, because of changes, especially at the federal level. So you have the Shelley versus Kramer Supreme Court case, which basically declared like race restrictive covenants unenforceable. Mm-hmm. Those covenants had been a really powerful tool of segregation for decades and just had walled off many suburbs from people of color from moving into those places. So the Supreme Court kind of knocks those down in 1948. And then in 1968, the Fair Housing law passed by Congress was another big blow to segregation. And that law was imperfect in some ways, but really, I think if you kind of take a broad view of things, it really did start opening the door to people of color having the right now in a new way with that kind of federal backing to be able to move into these communities that have been segregated for a long time. And so you really begin seeing that movement. And what's cool about LA is these trends were happening earlier and more intensely here than maybe in other parts of the country, although this is a national trend that's happening with this. But in LA, as a historian, like I could really glimpse these changes in a very vivid way as people of color started being able to move into suburbs. And the groups that like could do it easiest, earliest were Latinos and Asians. There was still resistance. Okay. There was plenty of conflict. But African Americans are also moving in. And by 1990, a majority of all three of those groups were living in suburban communities in LA. So you're already seeing like this trend taking hold and becoming more of a normal experience for Blacks, for Asians, for Latinos, and then of course for whites still too here in Los Angeles. So they're moving in, they're sometimes into communities that had been very cut off from them, sometimes to communities that had, you know, for one reason or another, that had more diverse roots too. So it sort of plays out in different ways across like all of LA County.
Okay. So I'm sure that with the influx of different not seen before in these community racial and ethnic groups moving in, there were challenges. What did, in your research, did you find were some of the more significant challenges that were faced as they began to blend into the suburban landscape?
Sure. There were, you're right, there were a lot of challenges. I mean, the biggest one just being white resistance. Mm. I mean, there were plenty of racist attitudes that were still pretty strong in a lot of communities. So there were examples of, resistance to these changes from, from neighbors, kind of getting together and trying to physically intimidate like people from moving in to, right. And also, not even just at the neighborhood level, but even pretty late into the game, like in the early 60s, some developers also just would not sell homes to people of color. And they were kind of open about it. They were worried that if people of color moved in, property values would drop. Mm-hmm. That was often the line that was used to justify that resistance. And so that just continues on and on. But in my book, I looked at four communities really closely and just to try to unpack like what that experience was like. So, people experience things from hostile neighbors or their kids getting called names at school, racist names. Right. To oftentimes the initial explosive conflicts would break out in the schools.
Right.
Because that's kind of where people were forced to come together in the public schools. And so you'd often see some of the worst kind of hostilities taking place in those settings, especially. And so it happens, I'm thinking of one community, which was a very high-end elite suburb called San Marino here. Mm-hmm. And San Marino started out lily white. It was a sundown town. So they basically didn't allow any people of color to, they allowed them in to work there during the day as domestics or whatever. But when the sun went down, they had to be out. And they had plenty of laws and things on the books to ensure that. But what they went through there was they became a receiving ground of Chinese and other Asian immigrants, which happens in the late 70s and into the 80s and then beyond. And when Chinese ethnic families started moving in, they met resistance too. And these were well-educated doctors, people that had been in the U.S. for some time and that kind of worked their way up the ladder of, career-wise and that kind of thing. And so they had the means to be able to move into a suburb like San Marino, which was not cheap to get into. So when they got there, they also met plenty of resistance. There was, there were white families that just did not want to see that kind of change. And they were getting blamed for raising the cost of local education in the schools because they were needing ESL classes. So there was some hostility towards that. There was hostility towards the fact that some of these newcomers didn't help in the schools or volunteer, which was part of a long tradition in San Marino. Just people, saying what one story that kind of came up again and again among the Chinese that I interviewed there is that the parents talk to the kids and then the parents who have these prejudices And then the children kind of internalize that. And then that would get like played out in the schools and that kind of thing. So it was maybe not as explosive in a town like that, but it was still happening in ways that was creating a lot of unease and the need to try to figure things out, which they ultimately worked through there in that community. But that was just like one little slice of the story. Like you look at other communities and it's playing out differently, maybe more openly, more hostile, mm-hmm. for sure. And I can, if you want more of those stories, I can tell you more.
Well, you know what? Because just like anything, where there are significant challenges, the reverse of that, I'm sure that some significant opportunities emerged because of the increased diversity in the suburbs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, some of that had to do with the openness of residents to that change and being, you know, really seeing diversity as a strength, a means for, you know, learning about other cultures or just people of different backgrounds. And also, I think, you know, recognizing that in our history, the suburbs have been really, you know, they've played a long role in the making of racial inequality in this country for generations. You know, whites had so many advantages in being able to live in the suburbs and buy a home and then pass on that generational wealth, you know, to their children. And just for it really helped give whites a leg up for a long time. And I think as more and more suburbanites, including white suburbanites, recognize that and wanted to undo that, you know, they, I think, had a recognition that positives could come from moving past that older way of being, you know, in our metro areas. And so, you know, for communities that I think truly saw that value, as well as for the individuals, you know, moving into these communities. Yeah, I mean, they brought a lot of richness and, you know, just different perspectives and all of it into these communities where, I mean, for LA, this is really happened in a very widespread way. Like every suburban community now in Los Angeles is majority non-white at this point. Mm-hmm. And even in terms of home ownership, that's true as well. So you're really seeing it play out here in a pretty intense way. But you know, some of the things that that diversity brought to the communities, there's plenty of ways that was enriching, I think, local culture and that kind of thing. But it was a little bit of a mixed bag too.
Right. So you mentioned a lot of the conflicts playing out at school because it's like one of the places where folks have to be together. So in your opinion or in your research, how did you see cultural and social institutions, schools, churches, civic organizations kind of adapt to accommodate this new demographic in their suburban life, or did they?
Yes, I think schools were actually really crucial hubs of that kind of facilitating that integration process. That especially was true where immigrants were moving in and people from different backgrounds. So the schools became hubs of like adjustment for immigrants. So for example, one of the communities I profiled is called Southgate, which is in Southeast Los Angeles. It started out very white, and then it was actually a center of industry in LA for a long time. And then in the 80s, when a lot of the factories were closing down, it flips from being white to majority Latino. And then to all Latino, it almost like completely flips demographically to where now that whole part of LA is like, you know, over 90% Latino. When that was happening, the schools truly became a kind of conduit of integration for new immigrants. Because one of the other things about the new suburbia is the immigrant story. I mean, what's become really typical in a lot of suburbs is that immigrants move directly from their home countries into the suburbs. They don't go into the central city and then hopscotch into the suburbs, but they're directly moving and settling in suburban areas. And so the schools became, like in Southgate, for example, the middle school formed a newcomer center, which was a place where new families could go for resources. It was sort of a welcoming center for immigrants themselves. It became a place where, like, parents maybe who didn't speak English, you know, they could go there and learn about, you know, how to navigate their way through the community, you know, like the government, local government or local social services, where the stores were, that newcomer center. They'd even give like little tours of new parents of the community. So just to help them acclimate and figure out like where everything was. And then the schools also were often a place where new parents in these suburbs first started engaging in the community, like volunteer at the school. They were often, you know, cared about their kids and wanted to know what was happening with their children. And so they would volunteer. And that often became like the first stepping stone of engagement in their communities. It was sort of an easier pathway for them to get involved. And right. That happens in a lot of different communities. On the other hand, the schools also be places where, you know, there was definite friction and division around, especially around like busing. Yeah, I mean, I found other examples in communities like Pasadena and Lakewood where Black-white relations got very hot, where the schools were kind of, you know, playing a different sort of role. And there was a lot of variation. And you also mentioned like churches. They too could definitely kind of ease the process of integrating newcomers into the community. Mm-hmm. But like a lot of things in the new suburbia, there were a lot of variations with all of this. You had some churches that might be really welcoming, others not so much. So it was kind of all over the map on some level. But I'd say on balance, I think like churches especially tended to lean towards helping kind of create more welcoming spaces for newcomers to these communities.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, you know, across color, race, ethnic, and economic lines, most people care about their kids, right? So that's an awesome place to find some common ground. If you, no matter what you look like, if your religion is the same, that's a common ground. So you can, at least that's something you can stand on where we're the same, because in many ways we're not. But these things can help to build a foundation toward better communication, understanding, acceptance, and those sort of things. So that's interesting. So I want to segue a little bit into your process when you wrote The New Suburbia. Like, what were your methodologies or primary sources for uncovering the stories of diverse suburban communities? I know you said it kind of centered on maybe three or four communities, but like, how did that work for you? Did you talk to a bunch of people? Did you give out surveys or have town halls? Or what was your process like, your research process?
Yeah, I love that question. Thanks for asking that. I mean, as a historian, so the place I always start when I do any kind of, well, most of the stuff that I do is I want to look, have some kind of data to help me understand what's going on. So like when I started this book, I knew that the suburbs were diversifying. That was a given. I, you know, encountered that in other projects and stuff, but I didn't really know like what that looked like. So pretty early on, when I started working on this project, which was quite a long time ago too, I have to confess, I started crunching and pulling together a lot of census data on LA County. And I ended up putting together this pretty ginormous data set on all. So there's 86 independent towns in LA, like independent municipalities. And so, and because LA is LA, it's very suburban in general. And so I had some student research assistants over the years help me put together a really big data set on all 86 of those communities from 1950 to 2010, looking at like about, I think we had about 54 variables. So by race, ethnicity, class markers, occupations, you know, women in the workforce, were they working, were they stay-at-home moms, age, education level, and also housing, like was, you know, was it mainly single-family homes, how was that changing, and home ownership too, like how is that evolving over time?
Right.
And so that was an incredibly valuable sort of empirical base for me as a researcher to look at that data and go, huh, okay, this is interesting. Like, okay, like there's not many Blacks, you know, in these outlying towns until, you know, such and such a year, or, you know, we're with Asians or whatever, like, you know, where, like to be able to kind of really see through the numbers, like what, how this was playing out. And so, and that data were actually, I got some, a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and we're putting up that entire data set on the USC Digital Library, which will be open access, just as a side note. But so the data was really key, but of course, you know, that only tells you a little bit of the story.
Right.
I mean, in terms of other research, I did a lot of digging in local newspapers, in local city halls. I would go looking at ordinances, like, you know, were towns passing new laws, like when things started to diversify, what did that look like? And then, of course, I did a bunch of oral histories, because really that is the best way to get a feel for the lived experience of this, that kind of emotional experience of what it was like for people of color, you know, to be moving into these communities. And I learned so much from those interviews. I did, I think, like around 60 interviews over the course of my work on the book. And not only did these people sort of tell me things about the history itself that I couldn't see from the written record, but just also that human, the lived experience of it, something you just cannot get in, you know, it's really hard to get that in written records. So I really valued my, all of those opportunities that I had to talk to people. You know, the other thing I do a lot is drive around places and just do, you know, visual surveys, or just look around, like, what does this place look like? Take tons of pictures. You know, like, why am I driving around a suburb that is, you know, over 50% Chinese, but I don't see any Chinese characters and any business signs? So things like that were all ways that I was able to observe, you know, raise questions that I might circle back and try to answer through different kinds of research, and just flesh that larger story out.
Nice. I like it. I like the driving around and just kind of experiencing a neighborhood for yourself and noticing things. That's
for sure.
That's awesome. So in what ways do you believe that your research and this book will challenge common narratives, stereotypes, misconceptions about suburban life and suburban diversity, if you think it will?
Yes. I mean, I think there are some folks who still really harbor an image of suburbia as a kind of segregated white space. Maybe that's starting to go down a little, but I think that there's still, people have that image, and I think it still has a hold on a lot of us. Hollywood loves this image. There's been so many movies that really portray suburbs as these sort of, you know, white places where the hero is trying to break free of the oppressive conformity or, you know, whatever. And even if you recall in like 2020 during the presidential election, Trump was even using this trope of the suburbs as a white space. And he was accusing Biden of saying, oh, he's going to abolish the suburbs because he wants to bring in affordable housing. So Trump was evoking the same image. And I mean, I think that image was reality in the 50s and 60s. Absolutely. Like I would never deny that.
Right.
However, after 1970, things really do start to shift. And my real hope with this book is that we kind of put to rest some of those older misconceptions about the suburbs. I mean, that, you know, these are really places where a greater cross-section of Americans are now living, you know, African-American, Asians, Latinos, immigrants, the poor, the rich, suburban poverty is a thing that has become more of a norm in many, many places. And so I think my real hope for this book is to just raise a kind of new way of reflexive thinking about the suburbs, so that if we think suburb, we think of something that looks a lot more like America, that it's not just, you know, this privileged white space. And so it looks more like America with the good and the bad, right? I mean, the problems, the challenges, all of it, the poverty, you know, all elements of it. You know, the other thing about this is that the suburbs really matter to our national life. Right when I was finishing this book, I was scrambling around trying to get a statistic on 2020, like what percentage of Americans lived in the suburbs as of the 2020 census. And I was really having trouble finding it. And I reached out to this person named William Frey, who's a demographer at the Brookings Institution in DC. And he wrote me back and they pointed me to this really obscure census table, which I was grateful that I would have never found it myself.
Right.
That table showed that 54% of Americans now live in the suburbs. That is a lot. That's more than cities. It's more than rural areas combined. So my little line about this is the suburbs have become America's center of gravity. And we really need to understand what is going on in these places, in all of their complexity and diversity and everything. And at the same time that they continue to grow, they're also diversifying. So yes, like LA has been ahead of the curve, but as of 2020 also, 45% of suburbanites in America are non-white. LA, yeah, maybe it's way higher here, but it's happening all over the country. And, you know, it's just something that we really need to be paying attention to in terms of the dynamics of community and, you know, politics, equity, how that's all like playing out in these suburbs that are more and more diverse. So that those are my hopes for the book.
Oh my goodness, you stole my question. And it was, what did you hope that readers would take away? So thank you for me not even having to ask that. But I do want to ask you personally, how or did doing the research for this book, studying the history of suburban diversity, how has it or did it influence your broader perspective on social issues?
Yeah, I mean, it has. Like, I don't even know if I can answer that because it's imbued in my being and my brain at this point.
Right.
I think, you know, it's describing these sort of new realities that I think a lot of people like kind of know this is happening, but I don't know that we're thinking about it that much in a like specific way. You know, we might have neighbors that are diverse, and it's not just by race too. It's also, you know, by, it used to be like typical suburban family was dad, the stay-at-home mom, and the two kids. Like that's all changing too. So there's more senior citizens, there's single people, divorced, multifamily, generational households, there's LGBTQ people living in the suburbs. Everybody's living in the suburbs. So suburbia is a distinct kind of place, right? It's a place where there's a lot of single family homes, people living in these homes with the yard, whether it's a big home or a small home or whatever. And it's often local governance. And so there's a lot of control that these communities have over land use and social behaviors in public, you know, zoning and things like this. And so what are these diverse suburbs doing with those powers, right? Are they welcoming in different types of people? Is there class inclusion? Yes, you know, communities might be more increasingly racially and ethnically diverse, but what's happening with like affordable housing or the problems that we're facing in terms of sustainability, right? I mean, the suburbs have been not great for that because they, you know, they take up a lot of land and resources. And so, you know, how can the suburbs kind of contribute to more equity in terms of inclusion by class, people seeking, you know, affordable housing, as well as, you know, caring for the planet and climate change and that kind of thing. Yeah. These things are so interrelated. I don't know how it is where you are, Kristen, but I know where I am here in LA, housing is so crazy expensive. It's gotten really out of hand. You know, my family members are thinking about leaving LA because they just can't, younger ones especially, because it's so, you just can't buy housing here. It's really gotten crazy expensive. And some of that is suburbia's fault, right? Because suburbs have put the brakes on building more housing, made it harder to do that through things like zoning, R1, like, you know, single family home only zoning, and that kind of thing. That's starting to change here. But it's going to take a while, I think, to really have us feel the impact of that. So I think for me, like digging into this history just raised like a whole gamut of issues that are really impacting our lives today, you know, in so many ways. I mean, I'm feeling it in my family, my kids, all of this. These are issues that are, you know, that we're facing right now as challenges. And how do we sort of overcome some of these?
I got you. And to answer your question, I live in a suburban town in New Jersey that was predominantly white a long time ago. And now you'd be hard pressed to find anyone white in my community. And everywhere I look, there seems to be new developments being built. And that's not just a single family. There are more townhouses, and then one part is for sale, and then there's the other part that are rentals. Lots of that going on here. And the price of housing here was, it's just starting to level off. There were homes in my immediate neighborhood that were selling for triple what they sold for years ago, and honestly, triple what they're worth. The market is just ripe again to bottom out, and people are going to be upside down in equity in their homes because they pay way too much for it, and it's just not worth that. So that's happening here. My last question to you, Becky, is what new areas of interest are you looking at delving into next? Anything new in the pipeline in terms of the new suburbia or another topic?
Well, one area I'm really interested in is this quote unquote suburban vote. Every time a new election cycle hits us, there's always a lot of focus on the suburban vote and what suburbanites, you know, what they want. Politicians are trying to figure that out. And yeah, I think scholars are too on some level. It's kind of hard to pin that down. So I was thinking of kind of taking a bit of a, because I'm a historian, just taking a bit of a historical look at that and see how that's been evolving. That's one area. And the other, I think, is I've started working with communities here in LA that are struggling to deal with their own diversity. There's been, I think, ever since 2020 and the George Floyd BLM, like there have been a kind of raised consciousness in a number of towns near where, you know, in LA that I've seen kind of more up close. I know this is happening all over the country where there's a desire of some racial reckoning of some of these communities to kind of take a look at their own past and see how they contributed to racial inequality and that kind of thing. So I've started working with some communities that have invited me to give talks about how segregation was put into place, you know, what were the tools of exclusion used, and then like what can they, and what was their role in all of that? Like what did that look like in their particular town? And then they want to know, okay, now what do we do? So, and that you know, you asked earlier about churches, and often these are happening by churches. Churches are kind of spearheading some of these efforts. And so I've started developing this thing I'm calling the Suburb Toolkit, which is ways that suburbs can harness their own resources to create more inclusive and welcoming and equitable communities at the local level, and just, you know, just create a more welcoming environment for people. And those suburbs used toolkits for the opposite for a long time.
Right.
Now it's the time that we sort of move things in the opposite direction. And what was cool about the research on this book is that I found examples in history of when they were getting it right and doing things well. And I feel like we have, you know, we can use those examples to help us, to help communities even now, like maybe replicate some of those things. Like, I mean, this is a minor thing that may seem not that important, but even a simple step, like there was something called Dinners for Eight that like one community did, where two couples of one race and two couples of another race would get together over dinner. And it was just a way for them to, you know, break bread together, to kind of demystify their differences, get to know each other, and, you know, just take those simple steps at the neighborhood level, like just a neighbor level of inner relations, to help build community, help people get to know each other, so you feel like some trust amongst your neighbors and this kind of thing. Even those individual efforts, it's not going to solve like systemic inequality and racism and this sort of thing, but even these small efforts can just help us build neighborhoods and a sense of of connectedness. I mean, the other thing, just really quickly, is one thing I hope this book does is helps build a little bit of empathy among readers for people of different backgrounds who maybe had to go through all kinds of, you know, bad stuff in order to just buy a home in the suburb, right? Like that was not always an easy thing. And just reading these stories of what that was like may help people build empathy for their own neighbors, you know, people of different backgrounds. So,
and guess what? I'd be interested to read when you said the suburban vote, especially now, I guess, because we're in a presidential election season and it's all you hear from the pundits and everybody. I'd be interested to see the data set on that.
It's a whole other area. And I would say that it is diverse. It is just the way the suburbs are diverse. You can't really overgeneralize about the suburban vote. It's going to be as diverse as the suburbs are. So it's, absolutely, if anything, you know, just to raise our consciousness about that, it's going to be a lot more complicated than, you know, a soccer mom, a white soccer mom somewhere. It's there's going to be a lot of other, there's a lot of other impulses and outlooks at work, I think, in the suburbs.
Absolutely. And the dinner for eight, while I believe that small things are how big things happen, so baby steps get you there too. So we're not going to understate the importance of the small things. I think that's an excellent, excellent first step. Because once you sit down and eat with somebody and you're like, huh, they eat just like me, or the demystifying of, you know, one population versus another is an important first step. So I love that. And I love the work that you did here. Becky, I am really super interested in any new, because I live in a suburban community. So I'm interested. I'm interested generally and as it pertains to the broader conversation about diversity. So thank you. And thank you for joining me. But we're not done. Now we get to do the fun stuff. We get to play 10 candid questions. 10 candid questions is just 10 random questions that I called from some ridiculously big list on the internet. Some are either or, and some require, you know, a little bit of thought to answer. So are you ready?
I think so.
All right. Question number one, sunrises or sunsets?
Sunrise.
Almost everybody says sunrise. It's just the start of the day. It's amazing. So, all right. Question number two. If you had a magic wand for just one day, what one problem in the world would you fix?
Oh, my God. Poverty.
Good answer. Question number three. Airplane travel or road trip?
Oh, road trip.
For sure.
Although I wish you could do that over the Atlantic or Pacific too.
Right. Question number four. What technological advancement do you think will have the biggest impact on our futures?
Oh, God. Great to say it, but it could be AI.
I think so too. Question number five. Handshakes or hugs?
Oh, hugs.
For sure. Question number six. What's the most valuable lesson you've learned from a mistake or failure in your life?
Oh, gosh. Maybe to forgive myself.
Good one. Definitely give yourself some grace. Question number seven. Mountains or beaches?
Oh, wow. Maybe beach.
Being from LA, I thought that would be an automatic beaches for you. All right. Question number eight. What's one question you wish I'd asked you during our chat that I didn't? And what would your answer have been?
Oh, gosh. You asked so many good ones. oh, my goodness. That's a tough one.
okay.
I think,
and if you can't answer it, that makes me feel good. That's a trick question, and it really is designed to help me ask better questions. So when somebody goes, huh, I can't think of anything, then I know I did pretty good.
I think you did great.
Awesome. All right. Question number 9, introvert or extrovert?
I think introvert.
Yeah, you give me introvert vibe. And question number 10, which is the same for all my guests. How can my listeners connect with you and get your book?
Oh, thank you for that one. You can go to my website, which is www.beckynicolaitis.com. That has a ton of information about the book and different things, projects and things I'm doing. You can find the book, The New Suburbia, on Amazon, as well as the Oxford University Press website. And, you know, hopefully at your local bookstore, maybe might start carrying it. My local bookstore here is Romans, and you can get it there. And we have another amazing independent bookstore near me called Octavia's Bookshelf, which is named for Octavia Butler. And you can go to their website, and I believe you can get it there as well.
Awesome. 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 So, Becky, once again, I want to thank you for your time today, for having this chat with me. Thank you for this book and for tackling a topic that most people don't even think a whole lot about, and they should. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Kristen. It's been great talking to you.
Yes. And guys, if you didn't write down all that Becky said, her website, all of that information will be in the show notes with clickable links to her website, her book, and any of her socials. And please, please, please don't forget to visit my little old website at www.thecandidshop.com, candid with a K, and listen to an episode, drop me a review, and share the show. And until we meet again, I want all of you to keep it safe, keep it healthy, and keep it candid.